I firmly believe that we deserve, period.
I just feel like it's important to keep saying that aloud, that this is us learning in public.
The foundation of how to not have trash politics is really just relationships, right?
So if you're not aware of how powerful you are, then how can you be using your power to bring others up?
We're giving you collective liberation. We're giving you personal healing. We're giving you millennial auntie with a mic.
You're listening to Scene, the podcast.
How far have you walked for men who have never held your feet in their laps? How often have you bartered with bone, only to sell yourself short? Why do you find the unavailable so alluring? Where did it begin? What went wrong? And who made you feel so worthless? If they wanted you, wouldn't they have chosen you? All this time, you were begging for love silently, thinking they couldn't hear you. But they smelt it on you. You must have known that they could taste the desperation on your skin. And what about the others that would do anything for you? Why did you make them love you until you could not stand it? How are you both of these women, so flighty and needful? Where did you learn this, to want what does not want you? Where did you learn this, to leave those that want to stay? That was a poem called Questions for the Woman I Was Last Night by Warsan Shire. I thought of this poem as I was preparing this episode about internalized misogyny, which I would define as behaviors or attitudes that reflect a hatred or devaluing of women and girls or of femininity, but are enacted by women and girls and femmes ourselves. Is that how you would define it? Is there anything you would add?
No, that's pretty on the nose. And that poem, damn, like, Warsan has always been, like, the way that she writes, I think, is so cutting. And hearing you, like, just the opening line about, like, putting your, like, your feet in somebody's lap and, like, doing all these things for somebody, I'm just like, I don't know if you mentioned in the definition. Could it also be self-hatred as well? Like, if you are a woman or a femme or a non-man, but, like, sometimes internalized misogyny isn't just, like, a hatred of women. It's, like, also it can turn into self.
Well, that's the thing. I think this runs so deep, and it's a tool that we use to harm each other and try to sort of get one up on each other. But ultimately, I think it always reflects a lack of value for ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I have some pop culture examples of...
So let's just, like, can I just say, when you said we were going to have this conversation, I was thrilled. I was like, finally. And I said to you, a place where we can put the pick me conversation. It's the pick me.
We've always wanted to have.
Because it was in our list of things to do for, like, the entire time we've had scene. Like, that was flagged early on. So I'm really glad that we're talking about this.
Well, it's funny because one of our listeners actually DM'd us on Instagram and asked if we had an episode on internalized misogyny. And I went to reply, of course, it's... And then I was like, wait, I guess we haven't actually done an episode on that. So thank you to that listener. And also, if you're listening right now, if somebody's listening and you're like, I didn't know we could make requests, you can.
You can.
And please do.
It's very helpful.
Because sometimes we can't think of anything.
True. So true. Yes.
Okay. So pop culture examples. I don't know if you remember this from a few years ago when Erykah Badu suggested that young girls should have to wear longer skirts to school so that male teachers would not be distracted.
Yes, I was very disappointed. I was like, old me would have been like canceled. But then I was like, this is internalized misogyny. This is definitely something that she feels like she's had to do to protect herself. And this is the measuring stick at which she judges young girls. But yeah, I remember that very clearly. I was on the internet as it was like happening and people were like, how could she miss this moment so fucking poorly? Like, damn.
And she was committed to... She doubled down. Like, yeah. I don't know if you remember this one. You might have been in high school still when this happened. I don't know. When the singer Pink did the song Stupid Girls, And she had a music video for it where she like dressed up to mock women that she viewed as, you know, vapid or vain or trying too hard to impress men. So just, yeah, very misogynist. Right. And the video ends with, you know, a little girl picking a football over stereotypically girly toys because, of course, things that, you know, boys are traditionally interested in are just inherently better,
right,
or less stupid than things that girls like.
Ooh, the devaluation of femininity altogether as like a part, like an arm or an appendage of internalized misogyny. Yeah, I remember the song. I never watched the music video, though.
Yeah, it's terrible. I wouldn't recommend it. But you know, what was interesting was it made me think of, because in this video, she's mocking, you know, like a girl who's making herself throw up, or like mocking, you know, women who are putting on a lot of makeup or wanting to alter their body surgically. And it was such a contrast to the Beyoncé video for Pretty Hurts.
I was just thinking about Pretty Hurts as you were talking about. Yeah, continue.
Yeah, where she shows a lot of the same things, but she shows it with empathy and, you know, showing the pain that women are in who do this.
Yeah, thank you.
Or who feel like they have to do it, particularly.
Sometimes you really are in sync, because I was thinking about, as you were describing the music video, which again, I haven't watched, I was like, the lack of empathy that a lot of us have internalized as being okay, because we're just making fun of, like, again, like stupid girls. Like even the title of the song is like this devaluation of like femininity and the sense of like, you're doing this to yourself. And it's like, what about if there was more to the story? It wasn't about us doing it to ourselves, but like the constraint and the confinements of like cis heteropatriarchy that makes us feel like the only way that we can exist is by doing and, you know, presenting ourselves in a particular way. But I mean, pink isn't like my gold standard of of knowing how to be, you know what I'm saying? Like,
she's not? Okay, well, teach their own.
No.
And then just to show that God herself makes mistakes and we can all learn to move past our internalized sexism and move into true greatness.
Nasty girl. I know you're going to say Beyonce, nasty girl, because you've
It is. And to be fair, it's all of Destiny's Child. I don't want to just pick on Beyonce, although Beyonce did. She was the main songwriter of the group.
Right.
But the song Nasty Girl slut shames women and includes lyrics like, nasty put some clothes on, you're looking stank. Nasty wears your pride, you should be ashamed. And very tellingly, the lyric, you make it hard for girls like myself who respect themselves and have dignity. Which, again, you know, shows that... often, if we don't have the analysis of power to realize it's patriarchy that's doing this to you. You know, what makes it hard for you as a woman in the world to get respect is not other women and the way they behave. It is patriarchy and, you know, a culture that makes it so difficult for women to have autonomy, to do the same things that men do. You know, anyone who is not a cis man in the world and, you know, a masculine presenting cis man struggles, you know, to be seen as dignified, as authoritative, as intelligent, as worthwhile, all of those things.
And I would narrow that scope to just even say like anyone who's not a cis, like het white man, because masculinity within racialized communities is like, there's still that conversation of like validity. How masculine are you? Is that really like, you know, a real man if you are not embodying manhood in a typical kind of specific kind of way? So,
well, and it's so interesting too, because it's like, we can break this down into so many different ways, because again, we're all performing identities in a way to try to get by in the world, you know? And so even like that cishet white man, you know, with a privileged class background as well, is still performing, you know? Yeah. Like he's still been taught to suppress any feminine parts of himself, you know? And so then you have a lot of men of color as well, even, you know, cishet men of color who are performing masculinity, you know, that much harder to try to get some of that power that's been taken by white supremacy.
Right.
And then, you know, you have women doing these things like, you know, fighting amongst ourselves or, and it's interesting because when I thought about like, why have we not done this episode yet? I think there is a part of me, I realized that has sometimes felt resistant to even talking about sexism as a topic because so often it is simplified down into like the oppression of women by men.
Right.
And not only is it not a binary, but also I don't even really believe in women as a category anymore because race and sexuality
so much
and
intersect with identity that make womanhood this like amorphous blob. It's not like this clean cut thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I hope we can bring some of that nuance into our conversation today.
Yeah, I feel like we will. And one thing that I just wanted to, and maybe we'll get to it, but you know how you just mentioned so often we're not able to identify or maybe even articulate that it's patriarchy that's making us feel these constraints in our performance of gender. It reminds me of something that I read about racism, specifically within racialized communities, with respect to a lot of the anti-Asian racism that's taking place and the conversations that are happening about the Black community and Asian communities and how we've been pitted against each other under white supremacy. And basically, what I took from that was like, so often we're instead of looking up at white supremacy and the power structures that are like pushing down on us, we're looking across, we're looking down and in that lateral violence. And so in the context of non-men and specifically thinking about how internalized misogyny functions, it's like, so often we're fighting each other and it's so ingrained in like cis heteropatriarchal tropes about women, like fighting over men and like the ways that, you know, like cattiness and all these things. And it's like the competition that exists between those of us who identify as women, because that's like, as opposed to being like, shit, like we're all getting fucked over by this thing called patriarchy. Why are we fighting each other? Specifically when I'm thinking about like race, but also like gender identity as well. Like why are cis women gleefully happy to gatekeep womanhood from trans women? It's disgusting when you think about how like when we are given a little shred of, you know, power or a leg up, or we think that our way of existing is like the most valid way, that we're so ready and willing to kind of turn on anyone else who wants to and is rightfully so asking for that seat at our table. You know what I mean? Like, I just find, anyways, like the lateral looking up versus like looking across or looking down, I think is helpful for us to think of too.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that in. So I wanted to back up for a second because by the time we met, we both were, you know, not that we don't have lots to learn still, but I think we'd both been thinking about these things and unlearning for quite a long time.
Yeah.
So over text the other day, we were talking about the fact that this was going to be a topic and you were like, oh, I have some stories and some things that I've been through, you know? And I was like, I've never known that version of you. So I'm really curious to hear about some of the ways that internalized sexism made itself, you know, rooted itself in you when you were younger.
Yeah, I mean, before we started this episode, we set our intentions, and one of the things that we both mentioned, like, we want to bring our truth and our, like, you know, candor and just sort of, like, not be, I don't know, censoring ourselves because there's, like, some embarrassment about who we were or how we used to be or whatever, like, how we've gotten to this sort of journey now where we're at. And I think one massive piece when it comes to the unlearning that I've had to do, the unlearning of like Christianity, and this comes up so often, like I can't stress enough, and I feel like a broken record where I'm like, Christianity really fucked me over, but like it really
did
a number on me. I really used to see myself as like a good girl. I really believed in that idea and that identity. I really looked down on girls that like people around me would identify as like fast or slutty or whatever. I willingly and perhaps even gleefully was like, just would shit on other girls, this is specifically like in high school, and I might not have done it like in an outward way, but the way that I would see myself compared to other people, and like I had a lot of internalized self-hatred. So that's it's interesting, right? It's interesting that like I still felt that way even though I didn't really love myself. And then when I mentioned to you, like, I feel like I've had 9 lives, it was like adolescenthood, and then it was my like late teens, early 20s when I was in a sorority, like by choice, because I was like, you know, this might be fun to like be in community with other white women. Like that was, I really, really craved proximity to whiteness. And I wasn't like, I don't think I'm black. It was like, how can I perform femininity in a way that is so undeniably appropriate, undeniably like, you know, palatable for other people. And it wasn't until maybe it was like second year, maybe it was third year. It was after my sexual assault, but like that was right before that. I went through my crisis line training for WAVA. And I had already started taking gender studies classes. It was called women's studies at the time, but now it's called gender, race, sexuality, and social justice studies at the University of British Columbia. And just like being in community with people who had different gender identities, were like out and queer, and like we're talking about things, it just kind of started making me think like, oh shit, like, okay, yeah, this is the vibe. Like this feels more aligned with who I want to be. And then my sexual assault happened, and I was looking around me at my sorority sisters and what was happening kind of in our community when it came to the issue of sexual violence. And what was happening was so much of like, oh, she was a slut, she deserved it, or we can't really trust her, or like, oh, but like, he's a nice guy, he would never do that, he's my like big brother, he would never, or like, no, we're taking this person's side. And it was like, and I remember feeling like really fucked up about that, and knowing how I felt, and then knowing the training that I just was had just gone through, and sort of like the context, like everything in my life starting to change and shift to this place that felt a lot more aligned. But I kind of was like, also, I would say by that point in time, I was like still trying to like break free from a lot of the internalized self-hatred, but also like I had to stand up for not just myself, but also for people around me that were like not being supportive, not being believed, not, you know what I mean? Like I was kind of one of those things where I was like, well, shit, no one's believing this person. Like, I guess I will, because I feel like that's like my place right now. I kind of felt thrust into it because my life had been changing, and I was like, shit, like I can't hold on to these ideas really of like some people deserving violence because of the way that they dress. It's like, I dressed the way that I did, and I got, you know, I was sexually assaulted, and I was dressing, quote unquote, not like a quote unquote good girl. You know what I mean? So it's just, there was a lot of things that were taking place in this like short period of time where I was just kind of like, I just jumped ship from like the hating on women piece. And it wasn't like I was like professing it outwardly. I just had this orientation of how I saw myself, and in relation to, I saw some women as not as inherently valuable in relation to myself. And suddenly when I was like, oh, I was treated like I was unvaluable, I'm like, oh shit. So we're all in the same boat, I guess. Like I kind of just like, that just like popped my bubble when it came to my own internalized whorephobia, my own internalized misogyny, my own internalized like slut shaming, like all these things, you know what I mean? So that's like the short version.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know for myself, my sexual assaults also were a huge entry point just in trying to understand, you know, and some of the people around me were going through similar things, and just looking around and being like, how is this possible? You know, that the, you know, men around us are doing these things, and that, you know, the women and the non-binary people around us are being victimized in this way. And you know, what's a way to understand that? Because it just seemed very clear to me that these weren't like one-off instances.
Yeah. I think it was similar to you. It was like seeing, there was like the writings on the wall. It was like all these things kind of coming together, and you're like, see, I just saw things in a bigger context. I was like, yo, when something happens to one of us, like that affects all of our safety. I just realized that I can't go it alone, that I need other women, like, at that point in time, it was like, I need other women to like show up for me and support me and like know that when I say that I have experienced harm by one of their quote unquote brothers or somebody's cousin, because one of my assailants was somebody's cousin that I still know, it's like, damn, like, I hope that you would show up for me in that specific way. And what I was seeing is that like that wasn't taking place. So it was kind of like, be the change. Because I was like, fuck, if y'all are not showing up for this white woman, like, I feel like y'all are not going to show up for me. And like, I mean, some did and some really didn't, you know what I mean? But yeah, the context and like seeing all the pieces kind of pulled together about how like what misogyny really means and what patriarchy really does, which is that especially in the context of sexual violence, it's like it just basically says some people deserve violence. Violence is inevitable if you do XYZ thing. If violence happened to you and you didn't do XYZ thing, then it was really not your fault. But like, let's still not believe you. And I sexual violence was like when I was like, I'm just gonna start from jump believing women, like believing survivors. Like that just kind of, it really changed my vantage point, if that makes sense.
Totally makes sense. Yeah, it's interesting though. So I never felt an investment in being a good girl or being, you know, the right kind of woman in that way. In a way, it was kind of the opposite. I was sort of seen as a good girl because my mom was very overprotective, so I wasn't allowed to do a lot of things that a lot of other people weren't, and I was, as a young kid, really afraid of getting in trouble, so that was sort of how I was seen. And so if anything, I very much wanted to like shed that box that I was put in quite young. And when you're in a small town, people decide who you are when you're like five. That's right. It for you until you graduate. So I wasn't invested in being, you know, the right kind of woman in that way. But I think where my stuff really showed up was like wanting to be like a cool girl, you know, like the cool girl who like, you know, you don't have any like feelings or needs or boundaries, and you can just like, you're cool with whatever, and like you're low maintenance, and you like the right things. I was never good at being this kind of person, to be clear. I didn't pull it off. It wasn't effective. But I tried. Also known as a pick me. And I wanted to, okay, let's get into this. Mm-hmm. I wanted to read a definition of a pick me for those who are not as familiar with slang. And the one that I love, the definition, is by Damon Young. And I want to say in his defense that this was in an article where he was actually trying to define or introduce people to the idea of a pick he, which is like the men's version. So Damon was not like picking on women in this. He just had to like explain this term in order to pick on men. And he has a way with words that like nobody else has. So David Young says that the term pick me describes a woman who, through her words and actions, is either implying or outright saying, pick me, men, instead of these other women, because I am solid wife material, and solid relationship material, and solid situationship material, and solid fuck buddy material, and solid Netflix and chill material. Basically, men, I can be whatever material you want me to be. Shit, I can even be a liquid or an inert gas if you wish.
Oh, God. That's a really great definition. Robust.
Yes. And I think a lot of people who date men or have dated men can really, really relate to this feeling of trying to combat, I don't know, the inherent disrespect that men have for non-men or even for men who are femmes by trying to prove that we can, you know, meet whatever expectations they have that might make them respect us, you know, might make us worthy of whatever, you know, their approval or their love.
When you were talking about wanting to be the cool girl, that resonates for me because there was a point in my relationship with Nolan where I was like, I'm done being the cool person. I'm done being the cool girlfriend. And he was like, what? And I was like, I just like want to be particular about shit. Like I just want to like, and I think there are a whole bunch of tropes and representations about what non-desirable women, I'm thinking about coupledom when it comes to heterosexuals, right? non-desirable women are like women who nag, women who are particular, who are high maintenance, who are this, that, and the other thing. And so it's like, you're totally right in the sense that a lot of non-men who date men internalize that there's a particular way that we're supposed to be in order for men to find us still cute, still desirable, in perpetuity, right? Like, it's like the honeymoon period is gone and you still want to be able to like be that person that your chosen partner still desires. And that does not include being a quote unquote nag. That doesn't include being quote unquote high maintenance person. And it's the malleability. It's like you were saying in Damon Young's quote, it's like, I could be a solid, liquid, or gas, like whatever you want. It's like the loss of identity, the loss of like self, the loss of voice, the loss of all of these things for the sake of what? For the sake of desirability, for the sake of coupledom, for the sake, and like we've talked about this before, but like coupledom and desirability are like the highest, like most important thing, right? Especially within our culture. Like, you're supposed to want to be partnered, especially if you're straight. You're supposed to have babies. Like, you're supposed to, like, that's an expectation. That's like a, you are a more quote unquote, and I don't believe this, but you are a more valuable woman if you were coupled than if you were not in society. And so I highly relate to, not because I was like going through my life being like, I can be anything that you want, men, because I really was like the opposite when I was having casual sex and dating. I was like, you're going to get what you get. And I was, but I embodied cool girl in that way where I was like, I'm defiant. Like, I'm going to tell you what's what and you're going to like it. And that's all. And like, it usually worked, right? But I also, there were also parts of me, especially throughout the like journey of my relationship with Nolan, where I have caught myself being like, in that moment that I said maybe like several years ago where I was like, I'm actually done being like the cool like girlfriend. Like, I just like want to be able to say what I want to say and not feel like that's stepping out of bounds or that it's going to cost me the relationship, you know, mm-hmm. because God forbid mm-hmm. the relationship end. And again, this comes back to being paired, being coupled is like the most important piece of like settler colonialism. It's like about baby making a nation building. You're so much more valuable mm-hmm. when you're, you know, in a couple with somebody mm-hmm. than when you mm-hmm. are single to the state, to society.
Yeah. And this is the thing, because I completely agree with everything you said. And I think it also goes so much deeper than being a woman and heterosexual coupledom. You know, I think that in Rahsaan's poem where she says, you know, all this time you were begging for love silently, being chosen feels so important, right? Like, so many of us living in this world, like, we have such deep wounds, you know, that we feel like we need to heal that by being loved. And in order to be loved, we need to be whatever our partner needs us to be, or we right. need to be desirable in the ways that we've been taught to be desirable. And when there is such an intense misogyny, which I would define very, again, broadly, it's not just the hatred of women and girls, you know, I think it's also the hatred of femininity.
Totally.
And I was thinking as you were talking about the ways that, you know, as a femme, that I might try to present myself to a masculine presenting woman in a similar way, you know, and thinking about the ways that masculine presenting women and non-binary people have also, you know, perpetrated these misogynistic ideas. But then it's not just masculine presenting people, you know, again, it's like totally. With other femmes or with other women, you know, we've so internalized this idea that being complicated, that being emotional, that being more than just like a low maintenance cool girl makes us unlovable. And that's the worst thing of all, right?
Totally. Like, the loneliness too. I'm like, I think about the person that I was when I was like in my early 20s and how I really was aware of the way that I presented, like the way that people perceived me, the way that my like sexuality was read, my sensuality. Like, I was just like really aware of those pieces. And I was so committed, I think, to to perform, like we're all performing, but I was really committed to like selling this idea of who I was as like, I'm a bad bitch. I'm cool. Like I really, really, and it was like, it cost me, like it did hurt. Like it was like, it ended up, in my opinion, creating this aura of me being like unfeeling, or all I could do was get really like mad about something, but I didn't have like, I wasn't affected by shit. And I think at the end of the day, when we're talking about internalized misogyny, like you said, it's like, it's so much deeper than that. It's about wanting to feel like you belong, like you're worthy of being in relationships, period. Like not like, and it extends beyond like heterosexual couples 100%. Like it's so much about, if I show the fullness of who I am, will I be accepted? And I want to talk a little bit more about this like hatred of femininity. Because I think it's so interesting that like a lot of the time, as you were mentioning, like Pink and like the end of the music video, and it was like replaced something with like a football. It's like that the ideal or like the norm is still to replace femininity with masculinity, and masculinity being the thing, like the gold standard of like women being tomboys. I think that's so fascinating because we're still not getting to the heart of what we're hating. And it's hating that which is feminine. In any way, shape, that which is feminine, that which is women, that which comes from softer energies. Like there's so many et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know. I think we're entering into this like beautiful place now where I'm seeing so many femme and feminine people reclaim the power that is being feminine and being sensual and being soft and being complicated and all those things. But I look back to like, yeah, like 10 years ago, I don't know if I had those representations. I think I would have seen those and been like, it wouldn't have appealed to me in the same way now, because I actually crave the duality of both. Like I want to be the cool girl, and there's a part of me that is that cool girl, but there is a part of me that is soft and tender and is complicated. You know what I mean? And it's interesting that so much of it is just about replacing one with the other, with feminine with masculine, and that being the ideal, as opposed to holding both and saying both can exist and coexist in ways that work for you as a person, as an individual.
Yeah, like when I was researching this episode, I came across like an internalized misogyny inventory online.
Ooh,
so it was
like
supposed to be this. Yeah, so a checklist to show like all these ways that you may have internalized misogyny. And one of the things on the checklist was, how often do I wear shoes that have more than a 1-inch heel? And I'm like, honestly though, go fuck yourself, because the idea that wearing heels means that you have internalized misogyny is a deeply anti-feminine position, right? And like,
but for a lot of second wave feminists, that would have been, that's like their radical feminist shit, where it's like, we're fighting, we're not about being high feminine, we're about androgyny. Like that was like the gold star about, you know, what I'm trying to say?
With
like,
yes, and you know, without recognizing that in many ways that was just a rejection of femininity and an embracing of masculinity. You know, what people see as androgynous is like, in many ways, you know, traditionally masculine.
Yeah.
And it's not to say, and you know, and there was another one about like putting on makeup before you leave the house. And it's not to say that we can't find misogyny.
Yeah.
If you feel like you have to put on makeup before you leave the house, there is probably internalized misogyny there. Although again, I think we might want to talk about that in much more depth. Yeah, because so there's beauty culture there, but there's also white supremacy there. There's also all kinds of different like body shit, right? You know, like as someone with acne being like, well, yeah, but like, I know that there are also men who want to put on makeup because they have acne, you know, and like the sort of like stigma, not that misogyny isn't a part of the way that I feel like I need to hit a certain beauty standard, but it's more complicated. And just the idea that, you know, if you put on makeup, so like if I like love to wear red lipstick, it's because I have, you know, internalized misogyny. And this is where you get to places like the Pink video, right? Where you just like make a mockery of women who, you know, present themselves in a certain way because you think that it means a certain thing, that it means that they're ignorant or they're stupid or they're not educated enough.
Right.
Without understanding like all of the ways that people express themselves or all of the ways that cultural things have more meaning than just the one that you might associate with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's more complicated. I think the conversation of, and I mean, pink is of the era of like girl power. And by girl power, I mean like white girl power, right? So it doesn't surprise me, again, that that is something that she would put out or had put out in the past.
You know? Well, again, yeah, like I think it's what you said about looking across instead of looking up. And I've had this happen more than once in my life with the tomboy type women. You know, there was somebody that I did like a therapy training group with who at a certain point after I, you know, came to the group and was talking about some particularly vile sexual harassment I had had on the street the night before. And as we were all talking about our experiences with that kind of thing, another woman in the group confessed to me that she was realizing this was her internalized sexism, that she had thought less of me because I wore red lipstick all the time and was usually in like a skirt or a dress. And that that was something that as someone who didn't really present as feminine, that was like something that she had, you know, judged and thought of as, again, like part of the problem or part of why men treat us a certain way or, you know, things like that. And when she said that, I was like, it's so funny. It didn't surprise me because some of the energy that I was getting from her reminded me of energy that I had often felt from my mom, who, you know, as much as she adored me always, I think she had a lot of internalized misogyny because she was more of a tomboy and she grew up, you know, in the 50s and 60s where, you know, gender roles weren't really as much of an option, you know? And so I think she ended up expressing that by saying things like, oh, women are so annoying and who'd want to be friends with a woman? They just sit around and talk all the time and they never want to do anything fun, like play sports or, you know, and they're just this kind of like attitude of resentment because, again, it's like, the gender roles were so strong and even now I think are still often experienced as so strong that it's easier to look across and have resentment for the people who are willingly, you know, on that side of the spectrum than to have the righteous anger towards the system that says that just because you're in a particular kind of body that you have to be at that part of the spectrum.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know if I've ever embodied or felt that way about like looking at somebody who is more feminine presenting. Because like I have, like I said, I haven't had 9 lives. And I think the way that I present myself right now, like Nolan and I talk about this all the time. He's like, can you imagine like 10 years ago, you wouldn't have dressed this way at all? And I was like, no, I was like very much like, I need to have like a long weave or long braids. Like I wore dresses and skirts a lot. I always wore makeup. Like, and I think I just kind of felt like that was going to do the most for me. Like that was going to help me out the most in just like navigating life because there's a part of it that's like pretty privilege is a thing or like being attractive and desirable to people. Mm-hmm. It does open doors for you. It is a part of privilege. Just looking at the way that we still have like rampant fat phobia and this like devaluing of bodies that are, you know, non-normative or not small or not skinny or whatever. And so, yeah, I think it's just interesting. And I mean, shout out to that person who was able to like identify that like they had internalized, you know, misogyny, looking at you and sort of thinking to themselves like, I thought less of you, although wild that they told you that, because like, damn, I would be like, why would you, okay, cool, work on that. Like that's, and I gotta say, I'm grateful that we're talking about this because just like everything, I mean, I think both of us agree that so much of this podcast is like learning in public, but it's fascinating to track the progress, you know, of how much you have unlearned and how you can kind of talk about things with some distance, although still some like embarrassment. And I mean, all that is to say so much transformation is possible. Like I wouldn't have been able to think about these things if it were not for so many brilliant intersectional feminists and friends mm-hmm. who have sort of like showed me other ways of existing in bodies, you know what I mean? Like presenting gender expression, like how your style and how beautification and how like different ways you adorn your body can like still makes you worthy, one, but also can like be so healing, you know what I mean? And like, and so I think I've come around to have a different orientation to like seeing somebody with a red lip, I'm like, you fucking wear that red lip. I love to see it. I think it's awesome. I'm like, I want to celebrate that. But I don't know if I would have had, I don't know, maybe I would have felt differently 10 years ago, you know?
Right. Okay. So in the spirit of learning in public, and I'll go first, I'm gonna ask, what are things that you still notice yourself needing to work on in terms of unlearning internalized sexism? So I know that a big thing for me is seeing men as arbiters of taste. So this was a really difficult thing for me in the past, thinking like men's opinions of what makes good music, good books, good art in general, ideas that are worthwhile, all those things. That has been such a difficult thing for me to unlearn. And a lot of times I feel like I've unlearned that a lot when it comes to my own taste and what I enjoy and how I feel about it. But then when I am around a man, those very rare times,
very few times you are.
That I'm around a man, I find myself still being very influenced, wanting to impress him or wanting to like say the right thing or, you know, show that I have good taste in his eyes. Can you think of one for yourself? I have more, but...
Well, I'm going to give you something that's more messy, I think.
Okay.
Because as we talked about earlier, it's like some internalized misogyny, but it's also so many other things. And so for me, as a Black femme with a shaved head who oftentimes dresses quite androgynously, I have noticed, especially during COVID when I'm wearing a mask, like people do a lot of strong double takes because I think people look at me and think I'm a Black man. That's honestly what I have to say about that. And so I notice myself basically femming it up. Like I have mannerisms. I might, you know, flash my ring a little bit. I might start talking. I might be more exaggerated. I might talk with my hands. I might like laugh. I might use my voice. Like just to, it's like a fucking call. Like, don't be scared of me. Cause I live in a very white space. I think, and it's like equal parts for me, safety. Like it's like about how people are perceiving me and how I feel like I might be able to access more safety if people aren't as threatened by me.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? And so for Absolutely. Me, it's equal parts, and it'll be, you know, when I am interacting with men beyond my partner, my initial response is to be very pleasant and nice and like amenable and like sweet in a way that I think is just like, this is going to be the easiest way for me to get what I need or what I want from this interaction. I just mm-hmm. see it as like an efficacy kind of thing. Maybe another one that I can offer that I'm like have to be completely honest with is like, in the instances that I have been in conversation with people who are talking about places that they work, and this is specifically about nursing, which is a very highly feminized like workforce. Like a lot of women work mm-hmm. as nurses. There have been times when people that I know have mentioned to me like, it's so gossipy. And I have in the past been like, there's lots of women there. Sometimes we gossip a lot. Like in my mind, I'm just like, oh, that makes sense. Like I have like defaulted mm-hmm. in thinking like that seems normal. And there's so much context around like why women talk, like why women are socialized to be talking and sharing information. And like, and there's so many ways that I think we like demonize that behavior of like being conversational, being relational in a particular type of way. But I've tracked myself doing that in real time before.
Yeah. And I remember when I also started to notice that part of the reason women are perceived as more gossipy is that when men talk about other people, people just assume that they're telling the truth as opposed to saying a rumor.
Ooh, girl. This is interesting.
Because yep. men also yep. talk about people.
People all the time.
But yes! It's not seen as gossip.
Girl, you better tell yeah. them people. Yes, that's so true.
Yeah. yeah. And then another one that I notice with myself, and I've gotten better, but I still definitely have the growing edge, is giving more credit to men than anyone else. Hmm. And so I notice, for example, you know, so there's this kind of well-known pop star thing where they'll take a song that's already written and they'll add like one line to it so that they can have a writing credit.
And wait, what? Sorry, is that a thing?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's very much
okay.
a thing.
Okay.
Yes. But I've noticed that I, like a lot of people, I'm quicker to doubt that a woman's writing credit is legitimate. And I'm quicker to believe that a man's writing credit is legitimate. And I think you can look at the ways that people talk about, like, for example, Beyonce versus like Michael Jackson, you know, as two of like the biggest pop stars ever. Mm-hmm. People are very, very quick to dismiss Beyonce as a writer, no matter how many people come forward to like talk about witnessing her write and produce, you know, so much.
Yeah.
But then there's like stories of, you know, Quincy Jones has talked about how Michael Jackson stole credit from other writers because he also was a writer. But then there's times where, you know, somebody else wrote that bridge or someone else wrote that and he would just not give them credit or would just steal things from other people. But Michael Jackson is very well known and established to be a writer. He's always thought of as a writer. And, you know, Beyonce still is not.
Yep.
And if that's, you know, how we feel about songwriting, it carries to everything else. I mean, we could do an entire episode on the way that fathers are given so much credit for doing, you know, even the tiniest amount of child rearing work.
Right. Yeah. One other thing that I wanted to add, just like as a general sort of cultural phenomenon, seems to be the case. And maybe it's because we're like the first woman to ever do XYZ thing. But I've noticed myself being sometimes like when something accomplishment happens, let's say, and then they're like, and they reveal who the person is. And if it's a woman or femme or just a non-man, really, I'm like, sometimes I've caught myself being like, wow, like as if women and non-men are like less competent at being able to achieve certain things. It's like, there's probably a whole host of reasons why this might be the first person doing that thing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like the surprise or the shock when non-men accomplish shit that we deem as like inherently only going to be accomplished by men.
Absolutely.
Embarrassing. Absolutely. These are embarrassing things, people.
Yeah. And I think that for me, so much of how I've started to unlearn these things is I've worked on shifting my default. So shifting the default to believing women and non-binary folks about anything that they say, or the default of being skeptical of something that a man says, you know? And that doesn't mean you never believe a man again. You like always believe anything that a non-binary person or a woman says. But if you can shift the default a bit, you can start to rebalance and unlearn.
Ooh, I really like that. I find that very helpful. And I think that that's a directive also to men, for them to work on their misogyny, is to shift the default of who they believe automatically and who has to have more, you know, receipts for what, and who we trust inherently, who we believe is more capable, all of these things. Like, it's honestly wild how baked in misogyny is in our culture, like in dominant culture. It frightens me because I'm like, I've tried to work on myself and just in general, and yet there are still so many things that I'm like picking up on being like, fuck, I didn't even track that. And when you had said men gossip but we don't believe, like, it's such a norm to not believe women, I was like, oh, like, where am I? And so shifting the default, I think that's a beautiful offering. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. So we could talk about this forever. Maybe literally, we'll just make this into a million part series. But for now, I want to end with another poem by Rahsaan Jure called For Women Who Are Difficult to Love.
Ooh, I love this one.
You are a horse running alone, and he tries to tame you. Compares you to an impossible highway, to a burning house. Says you are blinding him, that he could never leave you, forget you, want anything but you. You dizzy him. You are unbearable. Every woman before or after you is doused in your name. You fill his mouth. His teeth ache with memory of taste. His body just a long shadow seeking yours. But you are always too intense, frightening in the way you want him. Unashamed and sacrificial, he tells you that no man can live up to the one who lives in your head. And you tried to change, didn't you? Closed your mouth more, tried to be softer, prettier, less volatile, less awake. But even when sleeping, you could feel him traveling away from you in his dreams. So what did you want to do, love? Split his head open? You can't make homes out of human beings. Someone should have already told you that. And if he wants to leave, then let him leave. You were terrifying and strange and beautiful. Something not everyone knows how to love.
Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community and we cannot do this without you.